You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Obviously, lockdown can present challenges for users in terms of keeping your use at the same rate as when we weren't stuck at home all day. The last time that I talked to you guys, I was interviewing Ben Burks about safe cannabis use during lockdown in Auckland. We've found ourselves back in that situation over the last couple of weeks under a framework of legalization. Do you think that getting that kind of information out to users during a pandemic would be easier?
I think everything under legalization would be easier. You make something legal, it puts it in the open, makes it easier to talk about, easier to provide services and information. Ironically, with the government's, the draft law doesn't allow for online sales or mobile delivery. And so under lockdown, there would be a question over how people would be able to access their legal cannabis. So that would be, I think, something that the government needs to look at. But look, you put something into the light, take it out of the illicit market, put it into the light. There's so much more that you can do in educating people about safe use. Warning signs to watch out for, it would be really important.
Like you say, there's so many different benefits to bringing cannabis into the light. But I wonder, do you worry that the events of this year have overshadowed the referendum in the minds of voters? Where are we sort of sitting poll-wise at the moment?
The polls are on a knife edge, like literally. It's almost 50-50. And there's still a group of undecided voters, so it's probably more like 45-45 with 10% people still to make up their mind. And I think the big unknown is the stuff around COVID. Is it that everyone's, anxious, feeling insecure, worried about, what's happening in the world? I know for me, at the back of my mind, there's been this weird feeling since the start of the year about all of this and what COVID means. And with all of that uncertainty, does that mean that people will cling to the status quo, something that they know and therefore vote no? Does it mean they don't even have the headspace to ponder all of the different choices that are before them? Or will it be something that they've seen what happens when political leadership, relying heavily on public health evidence and advice, makes the right decisions, for public safety. And in that case, if we're in that kind of vibe, then maybe people will vote yes. But I think the second lockdown, from the vibe that I'm picking up, is that it's made people much more uncertain about the world. So I think it's all very difficult at a practical level. Absolutely, the media discourse has all been about COVID, and in terms of trying to fundraise for the campaign, it's very difficult to ask for money when people are really nervous about their futures.
So, since I last spoke to the foundation, there's also been a change to the election date, which obviously directly affects the referendum. Have your reckons about how this the cannabis referendum in particular might go changed since the election date change?
So many variables. It's an extra 4 weeks of campaigning, which brings 4 weeks of extra costs for everyone who's campaigning. It means that all your plans that you had, in terms of, we've booked media buy, TV ads and so on, we've had to push that out. With the staff, it's been a really stressful year with the campaign. Adding another 4 weeks is just adding another 4 weeks of campaign stress. It pushes, for university students, it gets really close to exam time and times when they're actually, wanting to focus on other things. And is that going to affect turnout? Are people going to feel jaded? Or does it give us 4 weeks to keep the debate going, to get COVID out of the way and to open up that sort of space for the public to have that important dialogue.
It's interesting to hear you touch on that. Do you guys believe that there's been sufficient messaging about how voters can access information to make our decisions about each referendum?
No, the government, I think the government's really mucked their side of their responsibilities. if you look at their messaging, you know, they're spending a lot of money on, you know, TV ads and whatever for both of the referendums. But all they're doing is referring people to a website, which is like the worst kind of marketing you can ever do. What we would have hoped is that the government would simply communicate what is in the bill, what are people voting for, what are the facts,
right.
And then leaving it up to the advocates on both sides to argue the heart side of it, you know, the emotional side, the why this is so important. And so it actually means that we're having to spend a lot of time doing the government's job for them to educate people about what is in the bill. What we're finding is that people intuitively, when they hear the word legalisation, they think of it as some kind of free-for-all. And so parents are worried about, you know, is cannabis going to be sold from the dairy? Or are you going to allow drug dealers into schools? You know, they have this vision of something out of control. But when you tell them about, actually, this is what's in the bill, it's stricter than the rules that we've got in place for alcohol and tobacco, they get really comfortable. They like it, you know, and they... Undecided voters tend to move towards yes when they get that reassurance. But that means that we've had to put focus on that because the government has done such a bad job.
Right. Whereas if they had been doing that from the get-go, would campaigning on the Drug Foundation's part have been more about the evidence behind the benefits of being compassionate when dealing with users and helping them to find a way to do it more safely?
Yes, yeah, we could have focused on the sort of the core values, you know, that drive us and you know, the rationale why, you know, a public health organisation like us of long standing would back something like legalisation, the benefits of being able to build stronger communities, of not criminalising young people, of instead putting resources into supporting communities, of not opening up real bad pathways into, you know, criminalisation, and you know, putting more money into health and education for community benefit. We could have talked about that much more, which I would have preferred. But so we're having to do a mixture of both, you know, educate people about what they're voting for, and then talk about the benefits that we think legal regulation brings.
Right. It's disappointing as well because I think around about a year ago I interviewed Te Ari Pōtiki as well about provisions for Te Tiriti o Waitangi and legalisation. Obviously, looking at Canada and America, we can see a lot of ways in which commercialisation has really helped white people over and above Indigenous groups. And I guess the fact that the government didn't say what's actually in the bill meant that the conversation couldn't even get there. That conversation just kind of stayed with Indigenous advocates. What do you make of sort of all of that?
I mean, this goes back to just the whole approach that the government took for the referendum from day one. I mean, one, you shouldn't make complicated law like this and put it to a referendum. You know, it's just dumb. They should have done it, you know, made law like we always make law, which is to write it, put it before Parliament, you know, hear public submissions, and then pass the law. And you know, the government took ages. They've had 3 years, and there could have been a fantastic process around consultation and engagement with all stakeholders, and particularly Māori. And that didn't happen in public. So yeah, look, behind the scenes, Māori Indigenous advocates have been working with government, and that has resulted in something really quite cool. If people look at the bill, they'll see that there's some things built into the law which weren't in the original draft but has been improved over time around ensuring that communities who have previously been economically disadvantaged by prohibition, largely Māori communities, need to be actively benefited by the law change in terms of how licences are given out, employment opportunities and so on. You know, there's important things like a criminal record for drug cultivation, cannabis cultivation or dealing or use doesn't stop people from getting a job in the industry. The way that licences have to be distributed geographically across the country, and there's a limit on the sort of the size of a company, how big a company can get. So you're not going to get, you know, as we're seeing in North America, the profits going into a handful of white businesses. Mm. You know, the way that the law's been written is that the benefits of the commercial benefits of legal regulation will be spread widely and with a proactive approach to communities who have been disadvantaged previously by prohibition, and it's brilliant. And yeah, you know, we haven't been able to talk about all that really cool stuff because we just haven't had the headspace. The country just hasn't had the headspace for it.
Yeah. So let's say there's someone listening right now who thinks, yeah, I don't think I got enough out of the Electoral Commission's campaign for how I make this choice. Where would you recommend they go to find out what is actually in this bill?
The Prime Minister's Chief Science Advisor website. Mm. And she was asked, Juliet Gerrard, the Chief Science Advisor, was asked by the Prime Minister to convene a group of experts and to look at the evidence, not just from the public health side, but mental health, the criminal justice side of this issue, and they've laid it out really clearly. The what happens if you vote yes, the benefits that come with that, or the potential and the potential risks, but also, you know, what happens with a no vote. What, you know, what system continues and what harms come from that no vote. And I think that's great as well. And then obviously we have our own website, onourterms.org.nz.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.